sort of the question on the table is about Texas identity. Is it Southern? Is it Western? Some people would say it's Southwestern, put the two together. Tell me, for you, what those terms mean, Southern and Western. You know, some people may think it's purely geography. Some people might think, well, that's climate and topography. Some people might think it's more of a demographic idea, a cultural idea. What does Southern and Western mean to you?
My goal was, how are you going to define those? And what criteria could you use? So I found three sets of criteria that I could use to define identity. Because I'd always heard this debate, are we Southern, are we Western? So I looked at, as you said, environment, which is a key indicator. The second one was race relations. How did the races interact in West Texas as opposed to East Texas? The third one being in terms of what happened during the Civil War. Was the Civil War different in West Texas than it was in East Texas? And all three of those, I could find distinct differences. So that showed that there was a different identity.
Well, let's go through those then. Kind of let's take those one by one, and let's start with the environment. Tell us a little bit about how the two line up in that regard.
The concept of identity is much more than just Southern and Western. We're much more than that and much more diverse and complex. But West Texas, per se, what I found was there was this shatterbelt region between the 98th and the 100th meridian. And the 100th meridian is, you can tell where that is on a map, where the panhandle, the eastern line of the panhandle comes down across the state. So west of the 100th meridian was really where you could see a distinct difference in West Texas. First of all, with the amount of rainfall, we always talk about the rain, but in the late 19th century, a study for the Congress by John Wesley Powell found that west of the 100th meridian at the 20-inch rainfall break line, if you were going to have successful agriculture, you needed to have at least 20 inches of rainfall a year. Now, much of West Texas doesn't have that and therefore needs irrigated agriculture. Otherwise, sometimes during droughts, you can have the Dust Bowl conditions again. So there was this 20-inch rainfall break line, which is a huge factor in terms of the environment of West Texas and has really dictated the way that people live out there in terms of ranching and farming for a long time.
When you talk about West Texas and you talk about water, that's one of the precious resources there. And so also is oil, which you mentioned in the book. And, you know, if we were to talk perhaps 20 years from now, 30 years, 50 years from now, West Texas could look very different because those resources are becoming more scarce and people are leaving.
Depopulation is a big factor, and we can visit that again. But in terms of talking about the water resources, they really are becoming more precious than oil at this point. And the matter is compounded by several factors. One is that irrigated agriculture uses 75% of the water. When you have growing urban centers such as El Paso, which desperately needs water, Midland paper has been full of stories lately about water rationing, how they're having problems with, you know, potential water supplies in the future. San Angelo, a lot of the reservoirs are low or empty. So what's going to happen in the future? You can't keep doing irrigated agriculture at the expense of the urban cities in terms of the population. So at some point, that's going to give way. The problem is compounded by people trying to sell or market the water. The land office tried to do that and then backed off. You notice that T. Boone Pickens has backed off of that and sold the water rights back to the panhandle. And then there's Clayton Williams Jr. out in Fort Stockton. He is trying to sell his water to Midland. If you don't have water, you're not going to have a population base out there. And as I said in the book, a lot of people are leaving the region because agriculture is not panning out to what it once was. And also you're getting these distinct demographic shifts.
Well, it's interesting if you think about Texas and its environment and climate and topography, and you draw that line, what is west of the line, obviously you've been describing. What's east of that line, though, is actually quite different. You know, we've got coastal parts, we've got marshy parts, we've got hilly, rocky parts here in central Texas. Even what's considered, I guess, southern is even kind of diverse within itself.
South Texas is a whole nother kettle of fish, which I don't even talk about, because Texas identity is so diverse, is so complex. And I just wanted to break the limiting theme that we are either Southern or we're Western, because we're so much more. So what I tried to do was show that there was this distinct West Texas that definitely was not Southern, and certainly that East Texas is Southern. There's no doubt about it. But yes, if you have the Guadalupe Mountains, which are almost 9,000 feet, the Chisos Mountains in the Big Bend, which are almost 8,000 feet, the Chihuahuan Desert, and low rainfall, clearly these are different than what's going on in Central Texas and East Texas.
You talk about that limiting identity, that Texas has to be, you know, some people want to call it Southern, some people want to call it Western, and that kind of boxes Texas in a way. How did we come to that point where we've got to call it Southern or Western? Is that something that historians are pushed to do?
I think it really depends upon how Texans want to use their history to create their identity or package their identity. Maybe we want to be Western to avoid looking at our Southern heritage. Maybe we want to be Southern because we might be a historian whose emphasis is on Southern history. Therefore, we'd like to make all of our area of study be Southern. But Texas is much more than that, and you can't just put it in a box and say that's what we are. And I think that's really limiting. We're very diverse, and that's what makes us so wonderful. Many other states do not have this incredible rich diversity that we have. And so let's celebrate that diversity rather than trying to limit ourselves. So I did talk about using not only our Western identity to avoid unpleasant parts of our past, but also our Texas Revolution identity, where we are unique, we're independent, we were a separate country for 10 years, we're special, and then you could also get into we don't need the federal government or to depend upon the federal government, which is clearly not true. They made the mistake on that during the Civil War, which we can get to later. But I think people like to use elements of their history while avoiding or neglecting other parts to serve their ends, to package their identity and say, I am this or I am that, or we are this or we are that, to serve their agendas.
Well, walk us through a specific example then, or a case study, if you will, of a time when Texas has sort of cherry-picked one example from history and said, oh, that's what we are. We're Southern, we're Western, maybe conveniently forgetting something else that may have also been going on at the same time.
Well, a good time would be right after Reconstruction. At the end of the 19th century, Texas has this shift from Southern to, we're in the progressive era here, so we want to be modern, we want to be progressive, we want to be moving forward to a fresh, new Texas. So we'd like to forget about the late unpleasantness. We'd like to forget about Reconstruction, military occupation during that time period, the fact that we lost the Civil War. We'd like to forget about Jim Crow and segregation and lynching. So during this progressive era, we adopt a identity that includes the Texas Revolution narrative. We're exceptional. And then we're also Western, which we are. So it's very easy. The other Southern states didn't have these alternative identities that they could hide behind. But in fact, Texas was a republic for 10 years, and Texas, in fact, is a part of Texas is, in fact, Western. So we could put on a cowboy hat and forget lynching. We could, adopt these various personas and ignore these other parts of the past. They couldn't do that in Alabama or Mississippi. What I'm worried about is that we start forgetting our true roots by adopting these partial truths. In other words, yes, we are Southern, we are Western, but it's best not to have it all one thing. Another great example is the city of Fort Worth itself. They adopted this motto, where the West begins. As I show in my book, the West does not begin in Fort Worth, but Fort Worth wanted to distinguish itself from Dallas. They're only 30 miles apart. Both of them voted for secession by a more than 3-1 margin. So how is Fort Worth different from Dallas? Well, they had to create a marketing campaign to show how it was different. So Fort Worth did have cultural identity with the West. They had the cattle drives, the Frontier Fort. They had the stock show. They had a Wild West show. And so those are certainly very Western in and of themselves, but they also had a fantastic marketing campaign, and they branded themselves as Western because everyone knows that Western destinations in the Old West sell big time because of Western movies, Western art. Americans and tourists love Western identity. So Fort Worth has done quite well by adopting a Western identity while forgetting that they are, in fact, just as equally Southern. Cowtown came out of the stock shows and the stockyards and the meatpacking plants. So that's definitely true. But what I worry about is people or cities adopting personas that are not entirely representative or accurate of their city. And then they forget their true roots and adopt this sort of augmented identity that is partially true, but not all true. And so we come to believe these things about who we are and we forget our roots.
Texas, during the period of the Civil War, is, I think, a fascinating picture. Can you kind of give us a description of Texas during that time along this Western and Southern set of descriptors?
In far West Texas, west of the Pecos River, a lot of the Texas history books don't even mention this or ignore it. But in fact, the Union Army occupied Texas west of the Pecos River from 1862 to 1865. When Texas invaded New Mexico in 1861 and 1862, that campaign did not pan out, and so they retreated back to San Antonio in the summer of 1862. The Union Army, which was in New Mexico, the Department of New Mexico, then quickly moved into the Trans-Pecos region and for the rest of the war administered that under martial law. But we don't hear about that typically because perhaps that's something we wouldn't want to hear about that runs counter to our identity. The other part is that area from, say, the Pecos River to the frontier line in 1849, which would be Gainesville to Gatesville down to Uvalde. There's this middle section there that was under the responsibility of Texas Rangers. You know, you can drive across Texas today and see historical commission markers that say that the Rangers defended the frontier during the war, but they didn't. And in fact, the frontier line fell back to that 1849 position because, you know, the Rangers were brave men, but they didn't have enough resources, they didn't have enough men, and they were overwhelmed. Many times they were facing superior numbers, and it was just chipping away. And by the end of the war, Indians and bandits and renegades had forced the frontier line back to this 1849 line in many positions. But the myth is, again on these markers, that the Texas Rangers successfully defended the frontier. And underneath this is really the story that we did not need the help of the U.S. Army and the federal government. That's the real deal there, is the sub-story. This is this independent thing again, is that Texas, our own forces were sufficient to do the job, but they weren't. Before the Civil War, the frontier line held and the civilian communities in West Texas stayed put. But when the U.S. Army leaves West Texas, then this frontier line falls back. The area becomes depopulated. Something's happening there. What's happening is that the Texas Rangers can't defend the frontier. And again, after the Civil War, who was it that defeated the Comanche, Kiowa, and Apache tribes? It was the U.S. Army, with help, yes, from the Texas Rangers, but by and large because of the U.S. Army.
That concept of the nature, depth, strength of the relationship between Texas and the federal government, we're still hearing about that today.
Can we or any other state make it without the federal government? I think the whole concept of the union is our strongest point. We are so strong united, and when we divide, we're obviously weaker. So just the concept of can we survive today? Who would run the Texas interstate system or our road system? Who would help us out with our healthcare system or with education? We need the federal subsidies across the board, and we're not alone. There's a lot of states in the West that have a independent streak that chafe at federal regulations. That's nothing new, but let's also realize that we are dependent upon the federal government, and that I think our greatest strength is the fact that we are United States. I also think about Sam Houston, who I think was Texas's greatest leader. He forecast that seceding from the Union would be a terrible mistake, and he was right.
Where does that fiercely independent idea come from?
Where this comes from is during the statehood period, from the Republic period, during the Texas Revolution. We fought a war for our independence. We won that war. We were a separate republic for 10 years. That's a lot to be proud of, and rightfully so. So I think that independence comes from war for our independence and what came out of that. And I don't think we should forget that or ignore that. That's something that we can be proud of. And I think it also comes from the frontier period of having to make a living out on the frontier. It was pretty tough being a pioneer out there. You had to defend yourself against bandits and Indians. And so it's a rough and rugged lifestyle. It's an independent lifestyle. It's sort of like, I've paid my dues. You don't need to tell me what to do. And I understand that. But at the same time, there has to be some give and take.
When any state, and I guess Texas in particular, because of multiple identities, talks about being Southern, having a Southern identity, race automatically comes into the discussion. And there is the part of Texas that has the Southern identity. Talk about how race plays into the Southern and Western identities of Texas.
That was a really hard one because you can say that there's segregation all across Texas. But then there's more to it than that. There was also segregation across much of the country, and especially the American West. In the American West, you had segregated movie theaters, restaurants, hotels, swimming pools, just like you did in Texas. So segregation is one thing, and it's especially in East Texas, in the eastern half of the state, there are these Jim Crow statutes, which are very codified. There's a whole set of laws about what minorities can and can't do in the eastern half of Texas. What I found was that in the western half of Texas, especially west of the 100th Meridian, race relations are milder. There are some of these laws on the books, but they're not as enforced. And a lot of this is informal or what we call de facto segregation. In other words, where we don't necessarily talk about it, but it takes place. You had it in El Paso, you had it in Fort Stockton, all across West Texas. So it's more of an informal segregation. This racism has been part of the national strain since our country was first founded. We've always had problems with race relations. And in the West and in West Texas, it manifests in a different way. Again, it's more informal, and then especially in the nature of violence. In East Texas, if you look at the number of lynchings in Texas, there's approximately 475. That's inexact number, but around there. Only 7 of those documented take place west of the 100th Meridian. So if you have, let's say, 90% of the lynchings taking place on Interstate 35 or east of that area, clearly something different is going on. And it's not just because there are fewer blacks in West Texas or fewer Hispanics per se. And then you also have not only lynching, but then in the South, they burn the bodies, they drag them through the streets. There's this spectacle spectator thing that really has this strain that goes on in the South that doesn't take place in West Texas. So why is that? I wondered about that. You had lynching in the Midwest. You had lynching in the western part of the U.S. But after a certain point, this begins to taper out. And by the early 20th century and on into the 20s and 30s, it really has become a Southern phenomenon by then. And most of the lynchings and burnings and draggings taking place are taking place in the South. And that's really a great indicator of where you are at that time period. This is not taking place in West Texas. For sure, there is, again, there's a handful of lynchings. There is violence out there. There's shootings. But it is nowhere near on the level that is taking place in East Texas.
As you say, in some parts of the state, that behavior was more codified in laws on the books. Other places it was more informal, but sort of just generally and universally understood. After those eras, after those either unexpressed or specifically expressed ways of being were gone, did those philosophies linger?
Yeah, they have lingered. And I would say that things really began to change after World War II. And I'll give you an example. I did quite a bit of work on the Trans-Pecos, and by the 50s and 60s, you're starting to get Hispanics back in office in city and county offices, whereas that had really stopped in the 1890s once you started to get Anglo majorities in those areas. So it's taken time, but now what you really have is in county after county, west of the 100th Meridian, you're getting Anglo minorities. So that Hispanics, if you combine the Hispanic and black populations, Anglos are now minorities in county after county. So that's changing. And obviously, more and more Tejanos are running city and county government out there. So attitudes are, of course, changing. There's no choice. But I think also that more importantly is that West Texas is really facing a tough economic future. There's this issue of depopulation that you mentioned. The economy is declining as oil reserves start to decline. The economic base is going to contract. So what's the future? These races out there know that they have to get along and cooperate if they're going to have any chance at weathering the tough economic future. So there's a lot more intermarriage and there's a lot more cooperation between the races in the western half of the state because they know they have to get along to face the future.
So you're talking about changing demographics and the changing face of Texas, if you will. What I'm wondering is, in addition to that, thinking about the concept of identity, I know here in central Texas, our population has increased dramatically by people coming from other states. Do you see Texas identity or way of being, that independent streak we've been talking about, changing at all as we have more people coming in from other places who either bring their own identities or just don't have that sort of Texas underpinning?
That's obviously going to happen to some degree, but I would really hope that we could keep some of that Texas character and Texas identity because people really give us a hard time about it. If you travel anywhere in the U.S. And as well as overseas, they sort of joke with you about Texas, but they also really enjoy that. And I think it's a very colorful identity that I, for one, wouldn't want to lose. I think that the bragging and everything's bigger and better in Texas is really good in some respects because there is a rightful source of pride that all of us take pride in. I just would hate for that to overshadow the reality of who we are, too, and maybe some of the things that we need to face to continue growing and working together to face the challenges of the future. I just hope that we don't become these cardboard cutouts and these one-dimensional characters that really are not representative of our whole identity.
You've mentioned several things during our conversation that are instances in history that either we may not know about or that may not be correctly represented when studying Texas history that really play a part in our identity. Can you point to maybe one central thing or one kernel of our history that really every Texan should know that maybe we don't know or that we're not as familiar with that really we need to include in our thinking when we think about our state and our identity?
I think that the recent textbook wars over our social studies is a good example of this. We've done an increasingly better job of this, but I would really like to make sure that the role of minorities and women is included in our story and that we don't forget that we're not just all cowboys and Texas Rangers and wildcatters, that increasingly we are becoming a diverse state, that we are becoming an urban state, and that we need to realize that our 19th century characteristics or symbols are not necessarily who we are today. But especially, I would say, we've got to make sure that the story of the minorities is well represented in our narrative. And I think that's becoming better as we go along. But obviously, the recent textbook wars, or the culture wars, as you will say, that is an indicator that there's still some distance to go on that.
Does the question really even need to be answered if Texas is Southern or Western?
No. Again, it's very complex. I mean, we're also Midwestern, and then we're also, you know, very much a border state. South Texas is incredibly different. What do we need to worry about that? We're all of those and much more, and let's celebrate the diversity, the complexities, and let's enjoy that. That's what makes us so rich, and that's what makes us unique and gives us, as you will, bragging rights that other states do not have, that wonderful diversity and complexity that we have.
Glenn Sample Ely is the author of Where the West Begins, Debating Texas Identity. Glenn, thanks so much for your discussion
today.
Thanks
for having me here.